Track session number 11237, reel 6.
Admiral Morgan Giles, reel 6.
Well, reverting to the naval side of things, my job was to operate from our little headquarters the motor torpedo boats and the motor gunboats who were coming across in very large numbers. And I had really dozens of them available for each night's patrols, and they were very, very remarkable boats. They were fast. They had radar by this time, most of them, or some of them. They packed an enormous punch. They had Bofors, and some of them had 6-pounder guns, and some of them had, of course, torpedoes, but the guns were really more used for that sort of fighting there. And we would send out patrols, perhaps 3 or 4 patrols a night, based partly on information which we got from the partisans, which was very detailed, and partly on the ultra information, although of course it wasn't revealed to be that, from my admiral who was in Taranto. And it was for me to brief these chaps in our ops room and settle which boats were to go on which and send them out and operate them generally. And they used to have really remarkable successes. Because the enemy were operating extraordinary mixture of craft. Some were very, very tough-skinned things, Siebel ferries and F-lighters and things like that, which was a tremendous target for these boats to take on. And a large number of them were requisitioned little old coasters, schooners with Italian crews, everything you can think of. And these are very enterprising chaps, these coastal forces chaps. I can't say enough good about them. One of the most notable was Tim Bligh, who afterwards became the private secretary to Prime Minister Harold Macmillan. And there was a Canadian flotilla over there. A lot of chaps, I don't be getting all the names now, but they were a very remarkable, enterprising lot of chaps. And if they saw that they'd got a schooner or something, which wasn't put up much resistance, they'd range alongside it, put across boarding parties in the old-fashioned way, shoot or take prisoner their crews. The crews were very often only too ready to jump overboard and tow this thing back. And one of them, which was called the Stella Bianca, was an ex-Italian schooner which they towed in, and we got all the rations designed for the German army and a lot of German ammunition and so on, which of course the partisans liked because the partisans used largely captured weapons. And we turned the boat over to the Yugoslavs, and they lined out the hull with planks inside, filled the space between the hull and the lining with gravel for use as armor plating, and put all sorts of captured Italian machine guns and so on all over her, and turned her into a gunboat, as they called it. And the only difference was, instead of being called the Stella Bianca, she was the Stella Rossa, which is the Red Star. And they operated her very successfully, and a lot of other extraordinary collection of old boats of various sorts that they had. Now, the gun running was still going on because stuff would come across in much bigger quantities in landing craft and so on by now, and in some of the Yugoslav coasters they used to send across to Bari to load up, come to Vis, our island, and from there they'd be transshipped into the Yugoslav fishing boats, which would be taken across to their strange little contacts on the mainland, which of course was enemy held, and taken away up little footpaths up into the hills on mules and all the rest of it. So this was going on simultaneously. And a lot of my troubles operationally were to keep our ships, our coastal forces, clear of the Yugoslav boats, because of course identity was terribly difficult. And the only way you can really operate coastal forces like that effectively, because in those small ships and with that speed of action, you can't very well challenge one another and so on. You've got to have fire at sight. And so I would give them a certain line, which I would agree every day with the partisan naval commander, a chap called Admiral Czerny. And I'd say, beyond that line, we fired everything we see. Yes, that's okay. But then, of course, he wouldn't know that some of his chaps who'd been lying up in the mainland waiting for an opportunity to get back again and had no radio and no anything would perhaps stroll across that line on their way back. And it was a nightmare to avoid sinking our own, you know, the partisan boats. It did happen on one or two appalling occasions, but mercifully not very often. As more and more coastal forces came across, we were able to operate further and further north into the islands. There were some quite amazing battles that took place, and the number of sinkings and so on was really quite astonishing. Now, simultaneously, the Germans were known by intelligence to be mounting a plan, because this island had become a thorn in their flesh, to mount an operation to attack it and capture it and recapture it from us. To prevent that happening, British forces began to be sent to the island. First, number two commando came across, commanded by Colonel Jack Churchill, famous commando leader, after he was taken prisoner. Then two Royal Marine commandos came across, 40 and 43. Then the Highland Light Infantry came across. Then anti-aircraft guns came across, and we had, off the top of my head, I think we had 8,000 British troops there at the height of that summer, by midsummer. And, of course, the commanders were not content just to say they're as defending forces. They would want to do raids onto the neighbouring islands. So the other half of my duties came to getting landing craft across from Italy and sending these commanders across for raiding other islands. The first raid we did on this was an island called Sholta, which is quite S-O-L-T-A, which is quite close inshore off Split. And two commando went across there. They, end of the day, they had captured the complete island. There were 106 Germans on the island, of whom 100 were taken prisoner, 5 were killed, and 1 was unaccounted for. And they were all sent back to Vis in triumph in our landing craft. That was very successful. I must just branch aside to tell you for a second that there was a remarkable old British naval officer called Admiral Sir Walter Cowan, who had been a commander-in-chief in the West Indies. He'd been the British Admiral in the Baltic in 1919 when the fight was on, and under whose orders Captain Agar, we were talking about earlier, had gone in and done his remarkable raid on Kronstadt. And Walter Cowan had retired many years before the war. He was a friend of Admiral Keyes, who had given him carte blanche to go as a liaison officer with the commanders wherever he wanted to. But instead of being a retired admiral, Admiral Sir Walter Cowan, he was to go as a commander, dressed as a commander. He was 74. He'd been in the Western Desert with the commandos. He'd been at Anzio. He'd got a DSO in World War I and another one in World War II. And he was the most extraordinary man. He was a tiny little man with an immense character. And he was a sort of mascot for the commandos. And so if they were landed on an island, he would stomp along with them. He was fit as a flea. And instead of wondering how many machine guns there were at the top of the ravine they were climbing up, they'd be saying, "Have you heard what the old so-and-so said this time?" And there's a story about him on this raid on Sholta. He went across with them. The technique was we landed them in the night. They hid in the vineyards. And then the Royal Air Force came to attack their garrison, which, as I say, was wired into this little town, at dawn, in the hope of keeping the Germans' heads down. And from exactly 6:59 or whenever it was, the RAF would still roar overhead, but not fire any more actual weapons, guns at the thing, and the commanders at that split timing would come up out of the vineyards, rush in through the wire and get inside and deal with the garrison. While they were hiding in the vineyards the night before, of course they had to be absolutely silent, and they were just brewing up on these little Tommy cookers, these little spirit stove things. And one huge, gangling, great Royal Marine Sergeant went across to little Admiral Sir Walter Cowan and said, "Want a cup of coffee, sir?" "No, thank you," he said. "Go on, sir, there's plenty." "I'm not the kind of bloody fool that says no when I mean yes." He was a fierce little man like that, but everybody loved him. He was a great fox hunter. He was knocked off his mule at Anzio, and they went to help him on, and he said, "That's good, isn't it?" He said, "Good? What do you mean, good?" He said, "Well, I mean, they have got the range, haven't they?" He was a very, very professional little man. Anyway, that's enough about him, because he was there on the island for many months with us. And he was a great friend of Tito's. I've got a picture of him and Marshal Tito having lunch together. Well, this went on for a good many months. And they knew from the Admiral in Taranto, knew from intelligence that the Germans were collecting gliders and all sorts of landing craft and things to take the island back from us. And Admiral MacGregor said to me, "You're like a tethered tiger there, and I hope they'll come and get you." Because he said, "We're going to send, in the times when intelligence and the moon and so on think they're going to make us think they're going to attack you, we're going to send destroyers to encircle the island." And there were, I think, six sectors, and each one of those had one or two destroyers in it. So if the Germans had come, they'd have got, I think, a very bloody nose. But they never did actually set out and do it. And we now know from their records that, I think about June, they thought this is going to involve disproportionate losses, and there were quarrels between them as to whether their army or the navy should do it, and that sort of thing. And in fact, the threat evaporated about June, but of course we never knew that. So we had to have all sorts of plans for what we were to do if they had attacked us. And the partisans had many more troops than we did, all based on this island. Well, the story is well known how Marshal Tito was, but his headquarters on the mainland were betrayed, and he had to escape. He escaped out of the back of a cave and got in this little locomotive and went through the woods. Was picked up by, I think, an American colonel, a little light aircraft, and got back to Italy. Now, Tito said, "Look, I must get back to Yugoslav soil, because otherwise it'll soon be known that I have had to leave Yugoslav soil and my movement will collapse because I think I run away." And so the Allied command said to him, because Fitzroy used to fly across there, you see, and talk to General Alexander, whoever it was, Caserta, and they said to Tito, "Look, you can't really run a movement the size of the movement you've got going now from the back of a mule running around the woods. Why don't you go to a well-held, strongly held, and fortified bit of Yugoslav soil, namely the island of Vis, and you'll be able to direct things from there." So he agreed to do that, and he was put in a Hunt-class destroyer called HMS Blackmore, and I was told to go down to the harbour and receive a VIP, and in crept HMS Blackmore, the first big ship it had in there, the first destroyer it had in there. And down went the gangplank, and out marched Tito and his secretary and this great famous dog of his, Tigger, and all the rest of his team. And they went away and established themselves in a cave up a mile above our headquarters called Mount Hume. And he had his headquarters in a little sort of fisherman's hut thing, or farmer's hut thing up there in the vineyards.
What impression did he make on you?
Tito was an amazingly charismatic man. He exuded personality and power of command, and they had fantastic respect for him, as all future history shows. He enormously respected Fitzroy, because Fitzroy, after all, I've said enough to indicate it, really created him, and I think he knew that all the rest of his life. He gave Fitzroy Maclean a very nice villa to live in, but he thought that would, if he did the same, he would be probably bombed, and so he continued to live very simply in this little cave. And one day, my admiral came over to see how we were getting on in a motor torpedo boat, and in a destroyer, in a Hunt-class destroyer. This was quite on, well on in the summer, and had lunch with Marshal Tito. Well, I was sitting there, and these partisan girls were bringing around fried fish or something, and there was a Russian military delegation there too, but they didn't have a villa like Fitzroy McLean did. They had bivouac tents outside Tito's headquarters, and when I used to go up there on my motorbike, I'd see these little bivouac tents, 2 or 3 feet high, with the Russians' boots sticking out of the end of them. And I heard my admiral say to Tito, through the interpreter, would he like to come out and see our destroyers doing a bombardment of an offshore rock after lunch that afternoon? And Tito said, yes, he'd like to very much indeed. And then there was a bit of a commotion, and a lot of whispering to and fro, and the interpreters buzzing from one to the other. And then I heard Tito ask to the interpreter, could my friend the Russian come too? Russian general, I think. And my admiral, who was a very nice chap, Charles Morgan, and a very good man to work for, I heard him say, no, I didn't ask the Russian, I asked you. And then there was more to and fro between interpreters. And then Marshal Tito said, well, I'm afraid if my friend the Russian can't come, I won't find it convenient to come either. So my admiral said, well, it's all the same to you. If you don't want to come, don't come. And I thought my admiral was being a bit stroppy about this. I wondered why. Because remember, the relationship was very, very odd, I'll go into a minute, between us and the partisans politically. Although militarily it was fine. And then we had some more fried fish. And then I heard Tito ask through the interpreter, was this to be an official bombardment or an unofficial bombardment? And my uncle said, oh, just a bombardment, you know what you like. And so then Tito said, well, I'll tell you what, if it could be clearly understood that it was an unofficial bombardment, then he'd come without the Russian. So he said, oh, that's right, down you come. They all got in jeeps, wound down the hill, got into this little port, went on board the destroyer, and they were just shoving off when, in the last minute, a jeep screamed down there. The lines were just being let go. A jeep screamed down there, and out jumped not the Russian general, but a couple of Russian colonels, and they leapt across the ship as she moved, so they weren't going to be left out of it anyway. Why was all this? Because they suspected that King Peter had come across in that destroyer. King Peter, of course, was living in Claridge's Hotel. But they were petrified politically of our relationship with the royalist government. And they thought that King Peter might have been in the destroyer. Now, there was a similar illustration of the extraordinary suspiciousness that seems to run in the Russian, I suppose in the Russian character, certainly did in those days. My friend General Churchill, who was the garrison commander of all the British troops there, with whom, of course, I worked very, very closely. He died only the other day, poor chap. I worked very, very closely throughout the months we were on the island, planning these raids and so on. He was invited to go and see this Russian general. And he went there. And the Russian plied him with an incredible quantity of vodka, or the local equivalent, which is called Slivovitz. And didn't seem to get on with what it was he wanted to see him about. And General Churchill thought, well, you know, I don't know what he wants to talk about, but I better get out of here while I can still walk, sort of thing, you see. Because by this time, the interpreter, who'd been partaking all the stewards to, had slid under the table and wasn't able to participate at all. The Russian had a little English, and as Churchill got up to go out, he caught him by the lapels and he said, tell me, my friend, just one thing. And Churchill said, well, what did you want to know? And he said, just tell me, between us, when that destroyer came the other day and Marshal Tito came out in the destroyer, was King Peter on board the destroyer? Extraordinary. Extraordinary political atmosphere. Now, I'll turn aside again for a second. There was a marvellous old man called Ivo Preradovich from a very old established Austro-Hungarian family, a famous family. He had been an admiral in the Royalist Navy in Yugoslavia and had been retired. He had lived in Split, where in retirement he had become the British vice consul, representing British interests there. When the Italians occupied it, they picked him up, arrested him for, you know, appropriate sympathies, took him back to Italy, and put him into prison, locked him up. He escaped. He walked right up round the top of the Adriatic and down the Yugoslav coast and came into Split, where he found his house burnt out, his wife and daughters missing, never knew to the end of his life what happened to them. So he thought, to hell with it, I'll join the partisans. So he joined the partisans. They knew that he was a former royalist and a man of authority, and they did all they could to demean him, and they made him line up with all the other sailors with his little tin pan for their food, his food and all the rest of it. He wore their uniform, which was just any sort of uniform they could, but all with this cloth cap on they had, with a little red star, which was cut out of red petrol tins, a red star on their hat. No badges of rank or anything like that. But he of course spoke very good English. And in the end, they thought, well, we must make some use of this chap. And they had a brilliant idea. They said, I know. We'll send him as a liaison officer at the British Naval Headquarters, at my headquarters. And so he used to come down every day, and he acted as a very useful go-between between me and Admiral Czerny if I didn't go up and see him myself and told us what was happening. We got to know him very well. Occasionally, of course, there would be this bora, the local gale, which blows furiously there. And we'd have a night of no operations, an opportunity for a party. And the partisan forces had a marvellous orchestra, which they'd collected from all over the country. And they used to send two or three musicians down to play in our mess. And we drink the gin and from our rations and sleep of it from theirs and that sort of business. And this poor old Ivo Preradovich used to go away at the end of the evening with his little cap in his hand, pointing at the red star on it, and he would look me in the eye and say, not so red, you know, not so red. The end of him was, after being very useful to us, and he reported to me in confidence what the commissars used to say in the partisan councils, you see, in the partisan meetings. And if they were being asked to do something they didn't like doing, they would say, time the British fought their own bloody war. It wasn't not an easy time. Anyway.
Did you say his name was Preradovich?
Preradovich. Preradovich, with a little thing over it. His end was, poor chap, that when I left there after a year, the command there was assumed by a chap in a destroyer, and this man went with him in his destroyer, and the first time they went out, they got onto a minefield, which we knew was there, and the ship was sunk and he was lost. Switch off. Now, there was another character in those days who was the commissar at Admiral Czerny's headquarters, because on the Russian model, every military formation had its commissar. And this chap was called Petar. That's all I ever knew him as, P-E-T-A-R. He was a huge, mountainous, swarthy Montenegrin, who were the best fighters, I think. A magnificent specimen of a man, very fine-looking man, with a huge, big, brass-brown grin. And one day he shot himself. Well, we said, oh, very sorry, sort of thing, and Admiral Cherney looked me in the face and said, oh, he has some troubles, you know. I went to his funeral. It was in a churchyard, but no cleric was allowed there. There were merely political speeches and clenched fists over his grave. And very long time afterwards, we discovered what had happened. The partisan orders, folklore, was that they had three great problems. One was prisoners. One was wounded, their own wounded, and the third was pregnant women. Because their whole campaign inland, their whole movement was based on utter mobility, disappearing, not having fixed battles. Prisoners were easy. They shot them. Pleasantly, they'd give them a cigarette, which was a great rarity, and then shoot them in the back of the head. Okay. Their own wounded were a terrible problem. They were the worst problem of all. That's why they were always asking us for medicines and so on, and we used to do a big evacuation thing. Our boats going back empty would take wounded and so on back to the mainland. Pregnant women was easy. There were, of course, girl soldiers mixed up working beside the men soldiers. They were terrific at throwing hand grenades. They were much more fiercely political even than the men were. And I've seen a camp where these people come back from a raid and they've been fighting for days and so on. And girls, they'd shout for the girls. The girls would produce huge great bundles, which were ground sheets. They'd spread them out, and then the soldiers would come along and queue up, and they'd be given a toothbrush each and a towel, and they'd go and have a sort of wash up as best they could under the village pump or whatever it was, and they'd come back and put the towel and their toothbrush back into the ground sheet for the next chap to use. And then when it was all finished, the girls would bundle it all up and take it away again. They were not objects of great pulchritude. They were all forced into British battle dress, which doesn't do its best for the female form. But, my God, they were tough and good. And if there was any rolling in the hay between these men and these girls, the rule was they were both to be shot. And that's a great deterrent. There was very little of it. Although there was one Marine who came to me with to state a complaint in the ordinary naval fashion. He said that he'd having a slight sort of making eyes at a partisan girl and that she'd been taken away. Well, there was nothing I could do about it, but that was the rule.
So this related to Petar?
This is what?
Related to this man, Petar.
No. Going back to the Petar story, there was no rolling in the hay. Right, well, they'd done a raid on the next island, which is Hua, H-V-A-R, which is the most beautiful of all those beautiful, beautiful islands, the most breathtakingly lovely coast we've ever seen anywhere in the world. They'd done a raid there, and they'd had a very successful raid. They'd driven the Germans out of it. And then they had a couple of days roistering before they got in their schooners and came back to our island again. And the island was so close, you could see it from one to the other. You could see when the Germans were in there, you could see their trucks moving around through their binoculars from the hill. And they'd had this roistering there. Now, this chap, Petar, had had a girlfriend who was the daughter of a very famous old intellectual or poet or something like that, again of a royalist family, who was living in retirement and seclusion in this island. And this Petar had a bit of a walk out with this girl. Now, Tito had on his staff one or two women. And if I'm right, I'm not sure if I'm maligning her, but she's long dead. She's called